The people we were 20 years ago would probably be breathless looking at how we use and rely upon technology today. You just pick up a device that gives you access to the world, and you can communicate, read news, watch TV, play games, buy stuff, you name it. In the process, we're interacting with software, apps, and algorithms that are designed to keep us happy and amused. What if we're not in the mood for that? What if the assumptions the apps are based upon are narrow in focus? Tech is created by people, and people are flawed. That's at the center of Sarah Wachter-Betcher's book, Technically Wrong, subtitled Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Sarah Wachter-Betcher has been working on the web for a dozen years now. She's a content strategy and user experience expert and the principal of Rare Union, which does research and gives advice to clients who want to do more with the web. Sarah Wachter-Betcher, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I see you're from Oregon originally. Why'd you leave?
I know. I miss it every day. I fell in love with somebody who went to graduate school out of state, and we ended up in Philadelphia.
Wow. Okay. So all the way across the country. Let's start out the discussion about Technically Wrong with our dependence on the web. I noticed the alteration to Maslow's hierarchy of needs that you have in here.
Yeah, so that illustration of Maslow's hierarchy of needs with Wi-Fi added to the bottom, I think can pretty accurately sum up a lot of our relationship to technology, right? Like, it's one of the first things we look at in the morning and last things we look at night before bed. I'm sure that's not true for everybody, but for an increasing number of people, myself included, that's definitely the case.
Yeah, you want to make sure you're attached to the world at all times, and knowing the Wi-Fi is there helps a lot of people relax. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what it is you do to help people and companies do their stuff on the web.
Yeah, so what I do is sort of in this area called user experience design. What I really do is help organizations make sense of how they can organize and design the websites, apps, whatever it is that they're doing to be more intuitive for people, to make sense, to have clear language, and to help people get things done. So a lot of work to ensure that the things that we put out there actually work for real life humans, which as I was going through the process of working with clients over the years, I realized that we were missing the boat in tech on a lot of things that real people go through that aren't necessarily all of those delightful, peppy experiences that tech companies seem to want us to have.
There is sort of a feeling of constant caffeine on the web, isn't there? The idea that everybody's up and peppy and happy.
Yeah, you know, somebody once described it to me as this sort of like relentless positivity. And I think that that's one of the most absurd assumptions of the web is that, like, you know, everybody is trying to have a fun and delightful experience at all times. Like, one of the examples I talk about in the book is something that happened to my friend Dan Hahn, where he had his smart scale send out this, you know, weekly email update, supposed to give you updates on how you're doing with your weight. And it's like, let's set a weight loss goal to help you shed those extra pounds. And as you know, these peppy messages, but they were actually sending them to his toddler. Because guess what? Every week when he weighed his toddler was gaining weight. And the scale just didn't understand that, like couldn't fathom a situation in which weight loss wasn't the goal. So they just kept sending these peppy reminder emails to try to get them to engage more deeply in their product. And it's just kind of ridiculous, right? Like, it's absurd to send out weight loss peppy updates to a toddler.
Well, it truly is, but this really indicates what the issue is, that there are assumptions made in setting up the product in the first place, and there are assumptions made by living, breathing people who don't consider what some of the other circumstances might be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I always keep in mind is that it's not that assumptions are unique to people in tech or that assumptions are necessarily bad. I mean, everybody makes assumptions. You can't get through the day without making assumptions. The problem in tech is just that these, you know, designers, developers are often not really trained to stop and say, well, what are the assumptions that I've made? And what might go wrong based off of those assumptions? Because of that mindset around sort of constant laser focus on delight and making this a positive experience, you're really not encouraged to think about what could be negative. I mean, that's kind of just, that's not a cool thing to talk about in Silicon Valley. And so as a result of that, I think people really go through their days often with blinders on and And whole companies kind of form with blinders on. I mean, I think we see that all the time. You know, I was thinking about this Facebook Spaces new feature that just was being demoed yesterday. Did you happen to hear about that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting. So what it is it's a like a virtual reality thing. So you can create these little kind of animated avatars of yourself, like a little cartoon image, and you can then go explore through this virtual reality headset different places. And, you know, Mark Zuckerberg goes to demo this yesterday, and he has this demo that has it going through flooded streets in Puerto Rico. And he's sitting there saying things like, oh, wow, it can really feel magical. You can really feel like you're in a place while he's, you know, like walking by these flooded houses. And it just comes off as completely tone deaf, where he's so excited about the technology, but he's sort of immersed in this disaster, and he's not, it, you know, it creates this like cartoon avatar in the middle of a disaster. And a lot of people were like, this is just virtual reality plus disaster porn. And this is really hurtful. And this is pretty offensive to the people who are actually living in Puerto Rico. And so, you know, he apologized for it. And I think he meant it when he apologized for it, but that kind of stuff happens over and over again at these companies because it seems that they, you know, they don't really learn.
And they're not hearing this for the first time from you. The book is new as of yesterday. Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. We'll get further into some of the goofs made along the way and the kinds of results that have occurred because of that and the responses of the companies to criticisms of this sort of thing in the past. Welcome back to Talk More. Sarah Wachter-Betcher, and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Sarah Wachter-Betcher, who's been involved in technology for a while now. She's primarily involved in user experience design and has written about apps and algorithms and the things that can go wrong based on the assumptions made by the people who make those apps and algorithms. Her book is called Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange by phone. We're at 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. She gave the example of the friend who had issues with his smart scale, which thought somebody in the household was gaining too much weight, which they should have been doing because they were a toddler. Another story here, though, that really sort of brings things to the fore is about what happened on Facebook to your friend Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. So a little while ago, back at the end of 2014, he logged into Facebook over Christmas and, you know, was expecting to see the kind of typical holiday update, people unwrapping their presents, whatever. And instead, he was confronted by something else entirely. It was an ad Facebook made for him for a product called Year in Review. They have been doing it every year since, but that was the first year that they had done it. And what Year in Review does is essentially go through all of your updates from the year, your posts, your photos, et cetera, and cherry pick the things that it thinks are the most popular and then package them up into a little album for you. And then it wants you to share that album with your friends. It's one of these kind of, again, peppy, fun things that Facebook uses to, you know, engage its users. And so that all sounds well and good, but what it had done is it had created an album for him and said, hey, Eric, here's what your year looked like. And the very front cover of that album that Facebook had put together was a picture of his 6-year-old daughter, Rebecca, who had died of aggressive brain cancer that summer. And they had taken her face and put it in the center of this album that they made for him, surrounded it with these Facebook-made illustrations of, like, people dancing at a party and balloons and streamers, and forced him to relive that. And he looked at that, and he was like, you know, I've been avoiding Year in Review. I don't want to use this product. I didn't ask to use this product, and I certainly didn't ask to have you decide what to put on the cover of this album and shove it back in my face. He found it really, really harmful, really painful to be forced to relive that memory, and especially, you know, wrapped up in this happy little package that Facebook had designed. So that happened to him, you know, we're going on 3 years ago. And at the time, that went viral, like, you know, all of a sudden Slate is picking up his story and et cetera, et cetera. And then Facebook apologized. They were really sorry that this had happened. You know, they clearly made their design choices make sense for somebody who had had a good year, who'd had, you know, I don't know, a dream vacation or a wedding or something. But for Eric, the most popular photo he posted all year was not a photo that was fun. It was a photo of the worst day in his life. And so they apologized. And they, you know, they actually started talking a lot about how they were going to change some things at Facebook. What's really frustrating about that story, though, is that, you know, we're going on 3 years later, and I've actually heard two different examples of almost identical things that Facebook is still doing as of, like, yesterday. Like, they're still kind of conflating popular posts with good posts, and it causes lots of problems for people. You know, one of the things recently they did is they, in an effort to get people who are Facebook users but who are not Instagram users to sign up for Instagram, they will show you advertisements on Facebook for Instagram, since they own both companies. And so those advertisements, what they'll do is they'll take, like, one of your friend's Instagram posts and insert that into the ad and say, you should be using Instagram. Look, your friend is using Instagram. And so they did that recently with a woman post who's a tech journalist. Her name is Olivia Salon. And the photo that they inserted into this ad and put all over her friend's account was actually a screenshot of email she'd received that was full of graphic rape threats. It was, again, one of her most popular Instagram posts, if you count popularity by the amount of comments that she got on it, because her friends were commenting about how terrible it was. It wasn't something you would want to insert in your fun and friendly little ad to get people to sign up for Instagram. But, you know, Facebook doesn't seem to have learned that lesson, right? That, like, popular content may or may not be good content that you want to resurface, and may or may not be something that is appropriate to pull into these new contexts.
Sarah Wachter-Betcher is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Technically Wrong, subtitled Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. So peel back the cover now. I mean, who are the people who create these kinds of products?
Well, you know, I don't know how much you've heard about Silicon Valley, but it is mostly men and mostly white, and that's been true for quite a while now. There's been, you know, no shortage of stories this past summer about sexual harassment in the tech industry, about sexual harassment from venture capitalists against women who are trying to get funded. You've maybe heard about some of the really, you know, toxic stories coming out of companies like Uber. That's the environment that so much technology work happens in. And I think you combine a really narrow industry, right? Like, an industry that's made up of a very non-diverse group, with the amount of sort of belief that group has that they are, you know, the best and the brightest, because, I don't know, we've been telling them that for so long, right? That we've been treating technology like it's this magical thing. So you combine those things and you get people who don't really have a perspective broader than their own, tend to think that tech skills are the most important skills and forget about the fact that what they're doing fundamentally affects people, and aren't really bothering to think about people who are different than themselves or situations that are not necessarily the normal everyday, but that are incredibly important.
So it sounds like that's a major part of your job, then, is to try to get the people who are really good with the techie stuff to think in terms of, like, how is this going to hurt or hit the person at the end of the supply chain here, the person who's actually the one you're trying to appeal to.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I would say that's kind of like the entire reason that I do what I do. The problem is that the culture in tech is so kind of lopsided towards the folks who are coming at it from a technical background. Like, that's where you have the largest amount of staff who make the most money, And it's also what, when people talk about the tech industry, they tend to be thinking about, you know, the brilliant computer scientists. And because technical skills are so prized, there's actually a really strong undervaluing of other kinds of skills. And I think that that's starting to change a little bit, but I think that it needs to actually undergo a dramatic shift.
So there are efforts at diversity in Silicon Valley, to be sure. You point this out, but how successful have they been thus far?
Well, I'll put it this way. This summer, Facebook went from 2% black staff to 3% black people on staff. And that was a big enough jump that it, like, entire news articles were written about it. So I would say it's not going great. In fact, there was an article, a study that came out from the Ascend Foundation just, I think it was last week, where they looked at official employment data from 2007 to 2015. So it ends a little while ago now, but relatively recent. And what they found is that during that time period, Black and Latino representation in Silicon Valley had actually declined. They found that there was, for example, a 13% drop in the number of Black women. And the other thing that they found was that, you know, we hear a lot about Asians in the technical workforce, and that's true, but they found that Asians were the most likely to be hired, but the least likely to be promoted. And so what that means is not only do you have very few people of color working in Silicon Valley and still a lot fewer women than men, although those numbers are a little better, it also means, you know, the people who are in power are really not changing. Having more diverse leadership is definitely something that is not happening very quickly at all. And I think that that's a real problem. I think it's a real problem because humans are not very good at seeing details that they haven't been trained to see or that they don't have personal experience in. Having diverse perspectives in the room makes a huge difference. And, you know, it's getting really scary, I think, because it's not just these kind of surface level problems like, you know, a design detail in Facebook that may be hurtful, but, you know, it's not necessarily the end of the world. So biases in Silicon Valley are now getting built much deeper into software products because of AI, because so much of the tech that we engage with is algorithmically driven. It becomes a sort of invisible undercurrent that is even harder to identify and root out.
We're talking to Sarah Wachter-Betcher about why our apps and algorithms occasionally blow it and just give us the wrong recommendations or give us things that are weird or hurtful or otherwise just off base. Technically Wrong is the title of her book, subtitled Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. You're welcome to join this conversation with us on the Jefferson Exchange. Ever get a weird response from an app or an algorithm or gut suggestion to buy something that you had no interest in whatsoever? We'd like to hear that story. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Sarah, if you would, tell us about personas and how those are used by tech people to build products.
Yeah, so personas are a design tool that have been around for a couple of decades now. And effectively what they are is sort of fake write-ups of people. So it's like, you know, Joanne is 37 years old, and, you know, this is what she does for a living, and this is the kinds of problems that she has. And they're a way to imagine a real person when you're designing a product or designing pretty much anything. And they're not necessarily, you know, bad or wrong. A lot of teams use them for lots of different reasons. But one of the problems that I've seen is that when people in the tech industry are designing things, they will start to laser focus on just a couple of personas that they've identified as normal users, typical users. And when they do that, they start making a lot of assumptions that that's what every user of their product is like, because they start to get laser focused on, like, okay, so this is for 37-year-old moms or whatever, right? And that really does lead to even more blind spots. So it's like a tool that at its best helps us keep people in mind and can be a really useful tool, at its worst can actually make us more likely to fall prey to stereotypes and more likely to leave people out because we get too hyper-focused on just a few details. So one of the things I see a lot of is, you know, people trying to put in all of this like fake demographic information. So they start talking about, you know, age and income and all of this stuff that sometimes isn't that relevant to the product. And what's much more relevant is, what are the problems that this thing will help them solve? Like, what are the kinds of things they might be going through where this product would actually come into play? And also, you know, are there people who might be using this product in scenarios that are not necessarily positive or good? You know, after Eric Meyer's story with Facebook and his sort of tragic year in review, him and I actually worked together on a book for people in our industry. It's called Design for Real Life. And one of the things that we talked about for people who work in tech is that it's really important to think about kind of the stress cases. So instead of just your typical user, what happens when, you know, somebody who's kind of at the edges might use your product? What happens if it's somebody who is in crisis, or what if it's somebody who just isn't what you expect from your user? Does it still work? And if it doesn't, you know, how can you mitigate that and make it work for more people more often?
Well, there's a great story in here about an app that allowed women to track their menstrual periods, and that got a little weird for a few women.
Yeah, so period tracking apps are such an interesting ground for talking about things like gender and bias in tech because, you know, obviously periods are something that a lot of people have, and there's a fair amount of apps that are designed to help people track periods, but one of the problems with a lot of them is that they'll kind of be really make a lot of assumptions about why somebody wants to track their period and what that means. And so you see a lot of apps that are like, you know, covered with pink flowers and hearts. And many of them are really hyper-focused on one of two things, or maybe both of these things, fertility and trying to get pregnant, or trying not to get pregnant. And those are great reasons to track your period. But what that really doesn't do is it doesn't include all of the other reasons somebody might be tracking a period, right? It doesn't include people who want to track things like other health concerns related to their period, or hormonal state, or just regularity, or just like what a lot of people have told me is just they just need to know when they need to buy tampons. And so what happens is that these products, and there's one in particular I talk about in the book called Glow, they're really, you know, designed to work well for one very specific type of user. And Glow, in that case, it's very much designed for women who are heterosexual and in a long-term relationship and tracking their period for fertility or to avoid pregnancy. And that's about it. And if you are anything other than that, it's kind of insulting. It has all of these messages that are like shaming you about, you know, whether or not you're using birth control, or shaming you about whether or not you're drinking alcohol, or all of these other things that are like, oh, wow, I didn't ask for my period tracking app to do this. I just wanted to track a period.
So is there some resistance, Sarah, from tech creators because they don't want to make their products too niche-y, or that they'd have to write that much more code to be able to accommodate the people who've got different circumstances from the personas they've imagined?
I think that's a really typical pushback where it's like, well, I can't design for everybody, so I couldn't possibly do this. And that's true. Like, you can't design for everybody in the sense of you can't anticipate every single scenario in the world. What I would say is that it's not about saying that you have to add necessarily any more work. It's more about saying a little bit of a shift in perspective and saying, okay, let me think about scenarios that are beyond my initial target. Let me think about what is the opposite. You know, what happens if I'm totally off about who is using this or how they're using it? And if I can make it work for somebody in that moment, then actually, you know, if you make something work for the people who are most at the edges, a huge percentage of the stuff in the middle kind of works itself out. You actually don't need to do more design work. It's not necessarily an additional thing. I think that that's true quite a lot of the time, that you can make something inclusive pretty easily if you just are willing to recognize that there might be flaws in your vision and address them early rather than you know, letting it go out the door and then get critiqued later.
Seems like this is where some of the genius could come from in tech, in the sense that people use your app for something you didn't intend for it to be used for, and then you realize, oh, this really is probably the better way to have this app set up, and you change it to conform to that.
You know, and I think the reality is, for all software, and this has been true forever, people are always going to use it in ways that you didn't intend. I mean, they're humans, right? Like, how many times have you used software that you don't read the manual for, you don't read the help guide for, you just start plunking away at it and you use it how you use it? That's what humans are like. And I think that the tech industry, at one level, you know, understands that, but actually doesn't behave that way because it's so believes that it is the smartest one in the room that I think it doesn't think it has to really listen to its users that closely.
Well, we have an email here from Ray who says, after answering many times their tell us why requests, Google continues to send me push ads for dating services. I've been happily married for more than 45 years. Stop sending these ads, says Ray. One example of ways in which things can go technically wrong. That is the title of Sarah Wachter Betcher's book. We'll come back and talk more with her and take some more contact from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking with Sarah Wachter Betcher, who works in the tech industry. She works on user experience design, trying to make sure that when people go on the web or use apps that they're having a good experience and what she can do to make that better. Through that process, she has learned a lot of things that go wrong in the tech industry when people make assumptions in creating apps and software and websites, and assumptions are wrong in a lot of cases. Her book is called Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a fun story in here about Madeline Messer, who I guess was in middle school when she started doing some research into game apps. What did she find out?
Yeah, that's a great story. So Madeline Messer was a middle schooler who was wondering why all the games she was playing on her iPhone didn't have girl avatars to play. And so she got really curious about this, and she asked her parents if she could do some research. So she downloaded all of the top games that were endless runner games, which is this kind of iPhone game where it's like you just play and play and play until eventually your character, you know, is killed, and then that's, you know, endless running. So there's a lot of these. They're a really popular style of game, and they're perfect for a phone, you know. So she downloaded the top 50 of them, and she went through them, and the vast majority of them did not offer a girl or female avatar at all. But almost all of them did offer a male avatar. And so the vast majority, that was the default. So what she was really looking at was, like, the default setting was that you'd be playing as a male character. And oftentimes, if you did want to play as a female character, you could do that if you paid more for it. You actually had to pay a lot extra in order to be able to play as a female character. And she found this really frustrating that her and her girlfriends couldn't play the games that they wanted to play using characters that they felt reflected them. And it's a little thing, but it's kind of like that alienation starts really young where you feel like, oh, this wasn't designed for me, was it?
Yeah, so they're not talking to me. They're not taking my case into consideration, which is interesting, obviously, in high tech now. But then we go much lower tech when you talk about the Air Force trying to have their fighter cockpits designed for the average pilot. And that was a real eye-opener for them then.
Yeah, absolutely. So the story that I talk about is from the book The End of Average, and the story is really that, you know, fighter pilots were trying to figure out how do we design planes for fighter pilots, and, you know, and they actually went through and started measuring pilots against all of these different criteria to figure out what an average pilot was. They found that most of the time those pilots did not actually have very much similarity whatsoever, and in fact that if you took the average of all the different 10 or something measurements that they took in terms, you know, height and length of this, you know, length of arm and circumference of waist or whatever, you took all of those things and you averaged them, that in fact you designed something that fit literally nobody. And so those kinds of measures actually turned into what, you know, what kinds of innovations that we would look at as being like obviously now, but things like having adjustable pedals, right? Like, so being able to adjust the pedal to your height, as opposed to assuming you could come up with an average height for the pedal that would work for everybody. We look at that and we're like, well, obviously we would do that. But at the time, nobody had really thought about that before. And it wasn't until they realized that there was no such thing as a good average. And that's true for most things, right? Like, when you try to design for the average human, you end up making a lot of compromises that hurt real people.
Yeah, because you're making assumptions, again, about what the average sort of thing is. And I noticed that in your own work, you mentioned you don't attach photos to personas anymore used to develop products. Why not?
Well, so one of the things that I found, so this is something that happened to me. It was actually a really uncomfortable meeting, but I used to include photos. It was pretty typical, kind of the way that I learned to make these things. And so I'd been working with this organization. We've been developing some personas for them that were based off of, you know, lots and lots of interviews with actual members of their organization. And so we had created these personas where we had, you know, somebody who was new to the organization, somebody who was a longtime member, who was a leader, et cetera, et cetera. And we happened to have a persona that was for that leader profile who was meant to be a CEO, and we'd used a photo of a Black woman. And we specifically wanted to make sure that our photos represented a diverse member base, which this organization actually had. But in a meeting, you know, the client that we were working with, so it was me and a colleague in this meeting, a big fancy conference room, and the client looks at that and says, you know, that's just not right, realistic. The Black woman wouldn't be the CEO. And we're like, oh, okay. You know, we try to talk about how, like, that's not really the point. You know, the point is more the motivations. We're also just trying to reflect the diversity of the member base. But he was really insistent. Like, we need to change that because otherwise people won't believe it. I'm like, okay. So we go back and we're like, okay, how do we want to adjust these? And so as we start switching things around, you know, you have to, sometimes you want to make sure that you make your clients happy. So we're switching stuff around. We're going to figure this out. And we're like, well, let's make sure that we still are showing a diverse range of people. And so we move some of these images around, and so we show a Black woman in a more junior role. And the next meeting that we're at, we're with a different executive from the company. So, you know, we're with, I don't know, the CTO and then the CMO in a different meeting. And he sees that photo, and he says, I want to know why you have a Black woman in a low-level position, because I think that's offensive. And I mean, of course, I sit there and I'm just like, oh, there's no good way for this conversation to go, right? Like, I'm like, this is not great. So I'm like, you know, I'm just trying to, okay, not going to get defensive, not going to freak out. Let me just hear him. And what I realized out of that scenario was that we had encouraged that kind of response by including photos in the personas. We had really like made it so that people were having these kind of visceral reactions, and they were losing the point. And so like that wasn't actually helpful to the conversation we were trying to have about who we were designing for and what their needs were. It was ending up being a distraction. So we'd intended to make it something that made people feel like they were more real people and you know, that it was including their diverse audience. And because it ended up being a distraction, we decided to remove them. What we used instead in that particular example was just more like sketchy illustrations of people doing office stuff. So whether it's somebody like giving a presentation versus working solo at their desk, to more show the different kinds of roles and kinds of people who they'd be serving, not getting all hung up on demographics.
To spread it out, so you're not just talking to Kathy or Bob or Hashimu or something.
Right.
All right. So and I've often wondered about this in polling, and long before the internet came along. Do we make assumptions that your circumstances equal your choices or your viewpoint? I mean, are we onto something there? I mean, if you have a certain level of income, live in a certain neighborhood, certain kind of house, are you generally going to feel a certain way about something? Or it seems to me there's lots of room for variation even within demographic categories.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that demographics are not valuable. I think demographics can be really useful, and obviously that there's some correlation between demographics and behaviors or attitudes. I mean, you know, like anybody who's done any social sciences would be able to point to those. I think the problem in tech is that they've been used in really reductive ways, as if, you know, more like as if they're one causes the other, or that they're uniform, that if you fall into this demographic category, then you're definitely this kind of person. And I think one of the reasons tech has been so reductive about that is, again, going back to who's working there. It's you know, a group of people who've been really prized for their tech skills, but don't actually have that much of a basis in other areas like, you know, the social sciences, communications, working with people. And so without that other backing to their technical knowledge, you know, they'll make some really broad assumptions as they're trying to serve people.
So let's talk about when people get into places where they have to do some inputs, they have to answer some questions or enter forms. And it sounds like simple binary questions on some web forms can tie some people in knots.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, web forms are one of my, like, the banes of my personal existence. I have quite a name. Wachter Betcher is a hyphenated last name, and it doesn't work online a lot. So oftentimes it's like, you know, a couple characters get cut off at the end because the database it's going into doesn't accommodate long names like mine. A system can't handle hyphens, so it squishes them together, or it puts a space between it instead. You know, I can't check into a flight online sometimes because it gets thrown off by the hyphen, and then I have to go to the desk, which is really funny because it's like, how many names have hyphens in them? I think that your airline could figure this out by now. But that's okay. So that's my name. And my name, it's like, that's a small, in the scheme of things, it's a small thing, right? It's kind of one of these petty annoyances. But what that is indicative of is this broader problem where people who are designing forms and are designing the databases where that information goes aren't necessarily thinking about real people. And that can play out in ways that are a lot more problematic. For example, one of the things they talk about in the book is something that happened to a guy named Shane Creeping Bear a little while back. So Shane Creeping Bear is a Native American, and he was active in Indigenous rights movements, and he tried to log into Facebook one day, and Facebook told him that his name was wrong, and he couldn't use that name. His name had been flagged and as a violation of their terms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and he was blocked from his account. And he was livid about this. And it turned out it had happened to a lot of people with Native last names. It had happened to somebody called Lance Brown Eyes, somebody called Dana Lonehill, somebody called, I think it's Lauren Kills the Enemy. And all of these people had been using their real name on Facebook. And Facebook requires you use your authentic name, the name that you go by in everyday life. But Facebook had flagged all of them for being fake. And what had happened, apparently, was there were people who were targeting those who were involved in Indigenous rights movements and trying to get their names listed as fake by Facebook. And at Facebook, the people who review that stuff hadn't realized the problem. They hadn't realized that those could, in fact, be real names. So they had a really narrow perspective on what a name could look like, much narrower than the reality of the world, where names look so many different ways. And they made them go through this massive process that was very much assuming that they were, you know, to blame, that they had done something wrong and they were using a fake name in order to fix it. It wasn't a very empathetic process at all. It was this process where it's like, you know, you need to send in a copy of your ID, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, even one of the people sent in a copy of his ID, Lance Brown Eyes, and it said on his ID, Lance Brown Eyes, and yet Facebook changed his name to Lance Brown. Just completely anglicized it. And he, you know, he's sitting there going like, how is this the response you're going to give? Do you have that little understanding of folks from backgrounds that are non-European? I mean, Facebook is serving a billion people, and I think that it hasn't taken this nearly seriously enough.
We have an email here from John, who had been waiting on hold and ended up emailing instead. He says, I completely agree with Sarah and her point on keeping a human impact focus in the design and implementation of these algorithms, but he urges us to keep this scale of impacts in perspective. If Facebook is 99.9% successful at accuracy and compassion, at a scale of billions in users at 0.1%, we're talking 2 to 3 million people if they have 2 to 3 billion accounts. And is that an acceptable percentage or number, he asks. And I'm truncating here a little bit. He says, it is critically important to maintain a human focus to make these algorithms and their applications more effective and positively impactful. After all, if for no other reason, there's a lot of money on the line for these companies if they can figure out how to do it at a scale of billions of users. That's from John in Arcata.
So I would say there's a couple things I would point out there. One of them is, I don't know how we know that it's 99.9% effective. In fact, I would argue that I very much doubt that it is. I think even more important than that, I don't think Facebook knows how effective it is. I don't think it knows how many people it's, you know, potentially alienating, because so many of us feel alienated by technology and then kind of think of it as something that we must have done wrong, or we didn't understand the product right, or, you know, kind of blame ourselves for it. And because, you know, we're so trained to think of technology as being you know, created by people smarter than us. And so I don't think that they're actually nearly as right as that. And then the other piece to that that I would say is, why are they doing it in the first place? I mean, it is not as if Facebook has to create these little albums to have you share with your friends. It's not like Facebook has to go and, you know, cover your profile with balloons and streamers when it thinks that you've done something exciting. It's choosing to do that, and it's choosing to do that because it knows that that might up their engagement metrics.
All right, a lot to think about in the book for sure. Technically Wrong, the title, the subtitle, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. It's a really interesting perusal of what goes on in the cyberspace behind the part that we access. Sarah Wachter-Betcher, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.